Can those in a coma still think? That's the topic today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. Understanding the human mind is mind-blowing. Our guest today to talk about mind-blowing things about the human mind, including comas, is Dr. Michael Ignor. He's a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at State University of New York, Stony Brook. There he's the director of pediatric neurosurgery, and he's a senior fellow of the Bradley Center and a frequent contributor to Mind Matters News at the website mindmatters.ai. Thank you, Michael, for talking to us again.
Thank you, Bob.
If you're in a coma, can you still think? Neuroscience gives us an answer. What does neuroscience say? I have down here in my notes, Adrian Owen. What did he do? And what did he tell us about comas and people thinking in comas?
Sure. Well, first of all, as a predicate, people usually take coma to mean that a person has no meaningful interaction with their environment. And there's a condition called persistent vegetative state that is thought to be the deepest level of coma. And it's not brain death, because brain death means actual death, but it's the closest thing there is to brain death. That is, it's a state in which it's been assumed that a person has absolutely no subjective experience, meaning there's no first-person experience. You don't dream, you don't feel anything, you don't think anything, you're just not really there.
But I assume there's still brain activity going on, right?
Yes. People in persistent vegetative state can breathe, they can control their heart rate, things like that. But basically, they've been thought of as a vegetable, that is, as a human body without a mind. And that's been the assumption for persistent vegetative state. Now, the reality is that families and nurses and doctors who take care of these patients very often have said that they really have the sense in caring for these patients, that they very often are aware of things. But it was hard to quantify. It was hard to put your finger on. Examples are that you can be in the room of a person who is either in persistent vegetative state or in other kinds of deep coma, and you can say something verbally in conversation that makes the person's heart rate go up or down. They seem to have an emotional response to what you're saying. But that's always been sort of anecdotal. So the question that one can ask is there any evidence that a person in the deepest level of coma has any awareness of what's going on around them? And that question was addressed rigorously first by a neuroscientist named Adrian Owen at Cambridge in England back about 15 years ago. And Owen took a woman who was in persistent vegetative state. She'd been in a car accident and had severe brain damage. And she had been in this state for several years. And he put her in an MRI machine and did what's called a functional MRI test. And a functional MRI test is a test that looks at changes in blood flow in the brain that we believe correspond to activation of parts of the brain. So you can kind of tell what's going on inside the brain during the time they're in the machine. So he put her in the machine, he put headphones on her, and he asked her to think about things. Now remember, she's a woman who supposedly is in the deepest level of coma, completely just a hair above brain dead. And he said, imagine you're walking across the room. Imagine you're playing tennis. Think of things. And he found activation in her brain. Even though she had massive brain damage, there were patterns of activation. So he then took 15 normal volunteers, put them in the machine, and asked them the same questions. And her patterns of activation were identical to theirs, looked the same. So he said, well, to a first approximation, it looks like she can think just like they can think. But then he said, you know, maybe the activation we're seeing in the brain isn't because she understands. Maybe it's just the brain's reaction to sound. Maybe, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you understand. Maybe just the noise from the headphones is causing this activation. So he scrambled the words. So instead of saying, imagine you're walking across a room, he would say, across, walking, imagine, room, you're. So it made no sense. And the activation went away. in her brain and, wow. and in the volunteer's brain. So he showed that the only time she had activation in her brain was when what was asked of her made sense, and her activation was indistinguishable from the activation of completely conscious people. So he concluded that she was able to understand and think about what he was asking her to understand and think about, even though she was in the deepest level of coma. So his research has been repeated by a number of other laboratories for many, many patients in persistent vegetative state. And about 40% of people in persistent vegetative state show high levels of intellectual functioning, even in deep coma. And there are ways of conversing with people in deep coma where you can, for example, look at the activation state representing yes and the activation state representing no. And you can ask them questions, you know, are you lonely? Do you wish your mother were here? Would you like something to eat? Stuff like that. And they can answer you with these brain states. In addition, some people can do mathematics in coma, or you can ask them, you know, is the square root of 25 6? And they do a no. Or is it 5? And they do a yes. So there can be very high levels, not in all patients that we've found, but in many patients, again, probably 40% at least, of mental function in profoundly damaged brains, to the point where actually the medical profession has added a category of patient to this list of ways you can be in a coma, and this is called minimally conscious state. So patients who have evidence of intellectual functioning in deep coma are called minimally conscious. Although, frankly, they're not really minimally conscious. They're quite conscious. What this research shows us, besides just the remarkable fact that people who we had previously thought were in deep coma are quite aware of what's going on around them, this obviously would have relevance, for example, to the Terry Schiavo issue that happened about 15 years ago, where this woman in California, in Florida, who was in persistent vegetative state from a lack of oxygen to her brain, was starved to death by her husband, supposedly according to what her wishes would be, because it was assumed that she had no consciousness at all. And this would suggest that there was at least a chance that she was very much aware of what was happening to her, which is what her family said, what her parents said. So it suggests to us that we should treat people in coma with a lot of respect and a lot of consideration and what I think ought to be the presumption that they are aware, and we should treat them that way. What this research suggests is that there is a disconnect between mental states and brain states. That is, that you can have massive brain damage and still have surprisingly high levels of mental function, which at least suggests it's an indirect evidence, but it is evidence that some aspects of mental functioning, particularly intellectual functioning, don't necessarily have a basis in the brain. That maybe that functioning transcends the brain.
Let me ask you a question, because we've talked previously about the difference between perceptual thought and abstract thought. In my mind, doing square roots is kind of like memorizing multiplication tables and such. It's just something you go to in your memory, and it's not true math. If you gave them a math problem they've never seen before, that would be true math. Is it possible to detect abstract thought in these coma patients, or is everything perceptual, or am I hearing you wrong?
Well, it's tricky. First of all, one has to ask, what is the difference between abstract thought and perceptual thought? How would you define them? I think the point of cleavage is between abstract thought and concrete thought. The classic Platonic Aristotelian distinction between abstract thought and concrete thought is that abstract thought refers to concepts that are completely divorced from any concrete object, physical object, whereas concrete thought is about a physical object. A very good example would be the difference between thinking about the hamburger that's sitting in front of you and thinking about nutrition. You can think about the hamburger, and it's a quarter pounder, and it's got cheese, and it looks pretty good. And you can think about nutrition. You can think about the fact that it's got 1,000 calories, and maybe that kind of would blow your diet. And those are two different ways of thinking. The problem for neuroscience is, of course, that we tend to think of them together. That is that, you know, by and large, when a rational human being thinks about food, there'd be some abstract quality to it, like maybe I shouldn't have that banana split right now. On the other hand, when you think about abstract things like nutrition, you're likely at the same time thinking about concrete foods. You know, maybe if I'm thinking about nutrition, I'm thinking about, you know, those fries I had last night really weren't the best thing for me. So it's difficult to separate out neuroscientifically thought about concrete things and thought about abstract things.
And that would be very difficult in the state of a coma for a neuroscientist to to differentiate between.
Although one could say that, for example, I think that asking a question about, for example, square roots. Yeah, you can. I mean, there's a lot of abstract concepts there.
Well, unless the patient is a nerd.
If they've just memorized the pictures, you know, if they've memorized what it looks like on a printed page, yes.
Yes, and again, I would refer back to the idea of memorizing multiplication tables and addition tables.
Right.
And I think that a lot of people that do mathematics for a living, like me, have that really at the tip of our fingers, not because of an abstract thought, but because that's what we do for a living. And we've been there a number of times.
Yes, and one thing that is helpful in at least seeing that there are two different kinds of thoughts involved is if you think of your ability, for example, I know that you personally have written extensively on Fourier transforms. And a person in Russia who speaks no English whatsoever can know everything you know about Fourier transforms. And a person in China can know everything you know about Fourier transforms, even though nothing about your languages overlaps. And you could imagine somebody, although I would imagine the written mathematics is similar, you could imagine somebody who uses different symbols in their mathematics would also know exactly what you know about Fourier transforms, even though they're using a completely different set of symbols. And so the knowledge that you would share in common with somebody who does not share your language or symbols would be the abstract thought.
I see. Do you think that there might be a clever experiment of the type that Owen generated that would actually allow differentiation between abstract and perceptual or concrete thought? Is there... come to mind?
Yes, that's a tough one. And there are people who've looked at issues like that, and there are all sorts of ways of approaching it. What I think is at least a doorway into solving that problem of separating abstract and concrete thought so it can be studied rigorously with neuroscience is to use Owen's rather ingenious approach of scrambling the words in the sentences so as to remove the semantic content from the sentence. And one could do that, for example, one could record the brainwaves of a person looking at a word on a card. And let's say the word was the word mercy. And when you see the word mercy, it evokes thoughts about the abstract concept of mercy. You could take exactly the same letters and scramble them so they didn't mean anything, and show the person the same card. So that for all intents and purposes, the person is still looking at a card that contains five letters in black ink on a white card. And the difference between the brainwaves of the card that says mercy and the card that shows the scrambled letters would be the brainwaves that correlated with the abstract thought. And if abstract thought is immaterial, then there shouldn't be a difference.
Well, you've kind of answered my next question. I think that most of Owen's stuff was done in, what did you say, an MRI machine?
A functional MRI.
Functional.
Yes.
Okay. Functional MRI. Do you think that that's always required? I think the functional MRI is going to be pretty expensive, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, the other way one could do it is with electroencephalogram, a brainwave study where you put electrodes on the scalp. Or you could even do it during brain surgery with awake patients if the surgery is for some other reason and the patient consents to being a part of a research project on mind states.
Brother comatose, in other words?
No, but you could look at it. You could look at this question of the neurological correlates of abstract thought in patients who are just awake. Looking at people who are comatose is one way of getting at the issue, but you could also look at it in people who are awake. The implication of this finding, I think, in comatose patients is that there is a disconnect between a mind state and a brain state that suggests that the mind state is not completely explainable by the brain state. But you could also look at that in awake patients.
Okay. Do we conclude then that humanitarian treatment of those in a deep coma should be to keep them alive, keep them nourished, and keep them going, even though they have very little capability of or possibility of being recovered?
Yes, yes. It supports the basic notion that all human beings, regardless of their physical condition, warrant respect, warrant compassion, and have a basic right to certain kind of fundamental things like food and like water, like hygiene, like shelter, like clothing. You know, it's just the basic ways you would treat any human being. I don't think that people in comas should be considered less than human. So I wouldn't treat a person in a coma with any less respect than I would treat somebody who was awake and sitting in a chair in front of me. I think that what was done to Terry Schiavo was a brutal, cruel thing. I should point out that when she was deprived of food and water, and it took her more than a week to die, when she was deprived of food and water, they gave her morphine, which you would think that if you really thought that she had no awareness, then why would you give her morphine? So I think even the people who were starving her to death on one level were concerned that she was aware, which is a pretty horrible thing.
That's an interesting observation, that their conclusion was actually self-contradictory in their treatment.
She was on a morphine drip during this. They gave her continuous morphine.
Yeah, it seems to me the treatment of people in deep comas parallels something like the care of severely handicapped children or such. So
I was at a medical conference during the time that she was being deprived of food, and there was a discussion during the medical conference about the ethics of depriving her of food. And most people at the conference felt that it was appropriate to deprive her of food. And I argued against it. Oh, yeah. It was widely accepted, or at least most people who spoke up. It turns out afterwards I found that a number of people didn't think it was appropriate, but they didn't really want to speak up. But I pointed out during the conference that it was ironic that we were having this discussion while a profoundly handicapped woman was being starved to death, and the conference was catered. So we were sitting there eating sandwiches, talking about starving a brain-damaged woman to death and saying it was okay to do that. And everybody, there were a couple hundred people there, everybody put down their sandwich. Nobody else ate the rest of the session because we kind of realized what we were doing. The other thing, the point that was made, and this really goes into medical ethics, but I think it's a very interesting question, is one of the rationales that was used for depriving her of food was that her handicap left her unable to get food herself, and that in some sense changed her status. That is, if she had lost that kind of autonomy, she was different, and that it was acceptable, since she couldn't obtain it herself, the food herself, that to let her pass away without feeding her. And so I asked the people at the conference, I said, is there anybody here that if you didn't have supermarkets and you didn't have caterers, and you didn't have people to make your food for you, could obtain your own food? Could you grow your own food? Nobody could. We all depend on other people to feed us. People like Terry Schiavo depend on other people to feed them in a very, very direct way. The rest of us depend no less on other people to feed us, only we go to the supermarket, we think we're feeding ourselves, but we're not. So I stressed that she was no more dependent on other people to feed her than we are. And it was just as cruel to deprive her of food as it would be to deprive any of us of food.
Yeah, it seems to me the philosophy of the sacrificing of coma patients is a slippery slope to Nazi Germany's condemnation of useless eaters.
Precisely.
To the point where people are condemned because they're not productive to society. Well, thank you, Michael. Our guest today has been Dr. Michael Ignor. He's a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at State University of New York. And for Mind Matters, until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.